Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm your host Dave Marshall and you're listening to episode 135, which is the first of two parts on the ethics of Burmese amber. And this two-part episode itself forms the second entry in a mini-series in which we look at some of the remarkable discoveries and ethical dilemmas both to be found within Burmese amber. Joining me today to give an introduction to the politics, laws, and markets behind every single scientific publication are Naseeba Raja and Emma Dunn, who have both previously worked on how colonial history and global economics affect our understanding of past life, and whose new paper on the ethics of Burmese amber is soon to be published. To accompany this episode, I've uploaded several documents and links to articles on our website, so please feel free to take a look at those, but be warned that the UN's report into the situation in Myanmar contains content that many will find upsetting. I feel that as producer of this podcast, I can't shy away from this kind of conversation that needs to be had, and will use this platform to that end. If you agree with that sentiment, please consider sharing this amongst your contacts. But given the backlash we get from such episodes, I'd ask those of you who will listen to not engage with some of the anticipated comments online, but support in the face of those will be much appreciated. Our backers on Patreon can this month expect our review of 2021 and also the first of this year's invited lectures. So please keep a lookout for those, and if you don't yet support us on Patreon, please consider doing so. I hope you find the first part of this episode interesting, and the second part will be released in a couple of weeks' time. Hi Emma, Naseeba, thank you so much for both making it here today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Right, we always like to start off by getting to know our interviewees a little bit better. So please, can you tell us about your academic backgrounds and your route into paleontology? So we will start with Naseeba.
Oh no.
That wasn't the reaction I was hoping for, you know?
I really have trouble introducing myself, but we'll try anyway. Hi everyone, I'm Naseeba. I'm currently in my final year of my PhD in paleontology. I usually work on coral paleoecology. My path to paleontology hasn't really been straightforward because I'm not really a paleontologist or trained as a paleontologist. So I started with a bachelor in geography, where I work mostly on natural hazards and, for example, like how society responds to natural hazards, and then went on to working in climate science. I dabbled in conservation biology for a while I was back in Mauritius looking for jobs. And then I ended up in Germany, where I started a master's in paleobiology just for fun. Thought I wouldn't. I didn't think I would stay more than one semester. I was looking for a job at that point, and I was like, you know, might as well go back to university and learn something while I was doing it. Didn't know anything about paleontology. Didn't know what a fossil was. And here I am, 4 years, 5 years later, doing a PhD in paleontology. So that's me.
Wow, you sound really, in a way, apologetic that you haven't had a normal background in paleontology. But I think that makes you stronger, having a varied background and being able to bring in different viewpoints and different perspectives other than just the solid geology paleontology route that, for instance, I've had.
Yeah, but it's also a struggle when everyone knows what they're talking about around you and you're like, what's a forum?
Even I don't know what a forum is, so...
But yeah,
yeah, I don't either, and I'm a micro-paleontologist. And, oh, I just heard the cat. Yeah. What are your cats called?
So I have two cats. One is called Nepomuk. That's the one you heard. He is very vocal. He speaks a lot. The other one is Noel. He's right next to me, but you will never hear him.
Right. Okay. Emma, how about you?
I've had a much more traditional route. I am currently a postdoc at the University of Birmingham, and my day job, let's say, consists of looking at the diversity of vertebrates such as dinosaurs, early tetrapods, and other reptiles. I spend a lot of time on my computer looking at data. And my route to paleontology, I kind of feel like I fell into paleontology a little bit. I was heading on down the ecology, zoology route from an undergrad in natural sciences and then a master's in taxonomy and biodiversity. And then I kind of landed here and I have not stopped.
Okay, so with your background, neither of you seem to have anything to do with either ethics or with Myanmar. So how did you begin working on the ethics of Burmese amber?
I was about to ask, do you want the short story, the long story? And I realized there's no short story.
It's a long road.
Do you want to start, Emma?
Sure. So Nasebe and I were initially put in contact. I actually think the first time I contacted Nasebe was to try and find some help with an ore package that she wrote. I was basically contacting her for work. But then we got like officially introduced by a mutual friend, Rachel Warnock, and she suggested that we should write a piece for the Palace newsletter on minority languages in paleontology. And she put us together because I speak some Irish when I'm back home in Ireland, and Nasebe speaks Mauritian Creole. So we were talking about how we might form a newsletter piece about this. And when writing and putting this piece together, we started talking about our research, and we both worked on the paleobiology database and noticed a very strong bias towards like English language literature and that kind of thing in the database, which is quite obvious to anybody who uses it. And we just went from there. We decided just to have a look at this and actually quantify it, take the data, explore the data properly. And it's led to so many branches of different projects.
Well, just to jump in there. So PALAS is the group of the Association of Paleontologists here in the UK and also in other countries as well. And then the Paleobiology Database, what's that?
The paleobiology database, these are things that I just completely forget to explain when I'm not talking to people I work with. But yeah, the paleobiology database is a huge database that's publicly available. So if you're near your computer, you can just Google it right now and it'll come up with this lovely map and some data for you to explore of all the fossil locations that have been added to the database from papers, scientific papers. And it doesn't contain all of the knowledge that we know about paleontology, but it contains a huge portion of it. I think at the moment there's something like 4 million occurrences or something like that. I can't remember what the exact number is right now, but it's a huge database. It documents a large proportion.
4 million? Last time I checked, it was 1.5.
Oh, maybe I'm completely... Oh, I'm thinking of I'm thinking of something different. I was getting very excited there. it's 1.5 million. Yes, sorry. I was thinking of 400 species. Don't mind me. Do not quote me. But it's this database. And the main point of looking at this database is because people like me and Nasebe use it to look at biodiversity through time. And it's what a lot of people will use to look at like the evolution of dinosaurs or how coral reefs responded to past mass extinctions. So it's a very important database in those terms. And we wanted to explore another side of it that seems to be underutilized or underexplored.
Okay, so does it have that kind of information as to what language certain publications been written in?
Yeah, it actually contains so much more information that is used. Yeah, it contains the language, it will contain all of the authors' names, the journals that these, or scientific journals that these papers are published in, loads of different data. I can barely think of any of it off the top of my head now, of course.
For example, for taxonomy, you'll have the type species, you'll have the locality where these were found, you'll have most updated taxonomic information. There's a lot in there that is underused, I would say. I think most people would just go and download, for example, Occurrences of Dinosaurs and look at, I don't know, trajectories through time. But there's a lot more there that people don't know about or don't think is useful.
Mm. Okay, I'm promising our audience now that I'm going to try and get an interview, an episode on the paleobiology database, and we'll just focus entirely on that and what you can do with it and what people have done with it. Because I honestly believe that we could talk for hours right now about it.
It's super cool, yeah.
Okay, but we've got a whole world, we've got however many languages that are around the world and that are not English. So why Myanmar, why Burmese amber, why focus on that area and that kind of fossil deposit?
I mean, I think at first when we were, so basically for another project, we were compiling data of where the research was being done and who were doing it. And while we were manually going through these papers, we noticed something strange about Myanmar or other fossils from Myanmar, where there was barely any researchers from Myanmar working on these fossils. And because the way we divided the work was Emma started in the 1990s and I started from 2020 and went back in time, Emma went forward in time. And in the 1990s, I think there was a lot being done at that point. So Emma didn't notice this at first, but as you go forward in time, the publications on Myanmar fossils really increase and you start noticing these things. And we just wanted to dive deeper about why this is. And this is how we fell kind of into this project where we started looking at Burmese amber and looking at the ethics around it, because this was a problem that was already known by the time we got into it. But for some reason, we asked ourselves why no one was doing anything about it or talking more about it. Because most people that I spoke to, I don't know about you, Emma, didn't really know about this.
Mm-mm. Yeah, when we were compiling this data, it was right at the beginning of the COVID pandemic. And we were seeing news articles pop up about it, and there was some very well-known ones that had appeared in like Science and the New York Times just the year before. And Naseba had noticed these things popping up in the data set that I just was not seeing because I was back in the 90s of the data. And when she was talking about it, I was like, oh, that's really cool. I'll let you know when I find one. And nothing. And then as soon as we arrived into the 2000s and 2010s, it was a completely different story. And while we were looking at these news articles, we mostly noticed that a lot of the coverage of this was by journalists, and particularly investigative journalists, and even local news media. So we wondered why there wasn't any scientists talking about this in any data-driven way or in any very traditional scientific way. And we decided to do something about it, I guess.
Well, we'll get on to what you did a little bit later on. But first, I think we should put everything into context in Myanmar. And so what is the current political situation there?
As we're recording, this is almost exactly a year on from the military coup that was declared last year. So there's currently a lot going on in Myanmar.
Yes.
So last year, there was the military coup where the military took over, and that was after around 5 years of a democratic government. And before that, Myanmar mostly had throughout history since its independence from Britain, a military government. And I actually checked the numbers before we started recording, and apparently about 12,000 people have been killed so far since last year, so in the space of a year, because after the coup, there were mass protests against the coup, and a lot of people were tortured, killed, were put in jail, for example. A lot of it includes also ethnic minorities, and these are only the ones that made it into publications or newspapers. So there's a lot more going on that we don't know what's happening about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, which are the political factions then? So you've got the government. Who else is in this conflict, and who controls the lands in which amber is produced?
So the land, primarily Chukchi, it's a province in the north part of Myanmar, and this is where the majority of the amber mines are. And the land there has been contested by the Chukchi Independence Army and the Tatmadaw, which are the government army. And at the moment, because of the coup, there's been quite intense fighting there and conflict that's been happening all across the last year, but this has been going on for decades since British rule.
Okay, and who is it that mines the amber? Is it like a local population of workers that do it? Is it the governments or the independence army themselves doing it?
All of the above.
Yeah.
So basically, amber mining really started properly in the 1990s, I think. And
yeah.
When it started, it was mostly artisanal miners, so the local population mining and selling the amber. And then at some point, there was a ceasefire in the region between the Chukchi Independence Army and the Tatmadaw. And then later on, when demand for Myanmar amber started really increasing, there was a lot more going on in terms of bigger scale operations. So we were not talking about artisanal mining anymore. We're talking about like large scale operations with machinery. And mm-hmm. this is actually one of the reasons why a lot of people were driven away from their homes. So there are a lot of internal displacement camps in the region because of mining. So this region is also known for other precious stones such as jade, ruby. So there's a lot more going on there rather than just, you know, amber being the problem. But this is like related to all the resources that are being found in this region, where people are being displaced from their land, and that's where the mining is starting, because you can find these resources all over the region. So this is very lucrative both for the Chukchi Independence Army and the Tatmadaw. So actually in this case, you know, it's not one, it's one side is good or one side is bad. It's actually like both sides in terms of the military are profiting from this resource. And this is one of the reasons why the conflict has been going on for so long, for basically access and having priority over these resources, where we do talk about the Chukchi Independent Army, but I think there's a disconnect between like the local Chukchi people and their interests and the interests of the army as well, which a lot of people don't consider, I think.
Reflecting on that, that's quite horrible for those local people.
Yeah.
I don't really know what to say about that. It's pretty awful.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I don't think it needs any other reflection other than that. It is horrible. So how does the amber trade work then? You've got these two different armies involved. You've got the local miners involved. So where does it all go?
So there are two main places that it's likely to end up. And one of those places is within Myanmar in Chukchi province. And that's Mitakinya city, which I've just learned is pronounced that way. So I'm sorry if I'm stumbling over it. But that's one place that there is an amber trade market. There's also a trade in other gemstones, like Naseba mentioned, like jade and rubies, I think. And then another one, or the more popular one that we might be familiar with as paleontologists, is across the border in China in Tenchong, where there is a very famous market for jewelers and collectors and paleontologists to collect whatever gems they might be interested in. but they don't always have to go through these routes. They can end up going through just changing hands across borders and being sold to whoever might be most interested in them, either for jewelry or for research. And there's often people who have personal connections there who will get the best of it, I guess, is one way of putting it, or like the best specimens.
So we've got a piece of amber, and for the sake of this interview and being in this show, let's just assume that it's got a fossil in it. We've got a wonderful piece of amber with a fossil in it. Are there any laws or rules about how that can be traded?
The short answer is yes, there are laws, but the bad thing about these laws is that they are totally down to how they are interpreted. And a careful person would err on the side of caution and interpret them very literally and walk away from this kind of material. But those who are very interested in getting hold of the specimen or very interested in getting it out of the country would read them how they wish. There are two different categories of laws that currently apply to fossils in amber. And one set of laws is to do with the amber that they're encased in, and the other set of laws is to do with the fossil itself. But there is no one law that is dedicated to both. And if you were erring on the side of the gemstone law, you would need an export permit, and you would need to contact the relevant ministries in Myanmar, and you would need to get permission to be able to export it. And this is what people would do, or should do at least, for mining that goes to large-scale mining and that anything that goes towards jewellery and that kind of stuff. But if you have a fossil, fossils must stay in the country, and you need to acquire permits again to take a fossil out of the country. And there are people in Myanmar who work on this kind of stuff and who would be able to house a specimen there in their universities or their museums or their geological institutes. And to find a fossil outside of Myanmar in amber actually should be really unusual, given that these laws exist.
Okay, so I am an amber dealer. I have a fossil in amber, and so I export it in the grey area of the law saying that this is a gemstone.
Yes.
And then later, when it's been exported, it just so happens that this gemstone also has a fossil in it?
Yep.
So that's the loophole?
That kind of is. So the loophole actually is a little bit more blatant than that. Apparently you can get away with not having any export permits at all, because there's nowhere in scientific research that checks for these kinds of things. You don't see journals asking for paperwork before you publish a paper on these kind of specimens.
I mean, on any kind of specimen, to
That's
be honest.
True. Yeah. So it doesn't even need to have any kind of export. Unless you're expecting to get caught by the authorities in Myanmar, then I guess people decide not to bother.
So it's just a blatant, like, we'll just ignore the rules, and now it's in a different country.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, a lot of people can just go on eBay, put in Burmese amber or Myanmar amber, and buy a piece of amber. Like, this is how easy it is to access amber. I can just go down to the city center and buy amber. It's not like, you know, you have to track an amber dealer in Myanmar or figure out where it's coming from. It's as easy as going on eBay and getting a load of it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I guess from the opposite side of it, are there any rules? So you say, like, the other major market for this amber is in China. Are there any rules saying, okay, you're not allowed to import dodgy gems or fossils into China?
I'm going to say that many countries have many rules about many things, but some of the rules are not implemented or enforced, and some of them are very much ignored. But as far as I've read, very recently, the Chinese government was starting to tackle smuggling into the country. So whether or not that falls within the scope of Myanmar or not, I am not really sure yet.
I guess behind all of this, at the back of it all, is that amber dealing and other gemstone dealing is a very profitable business, and sticking to the rules would very much harm this business. And just because there are laws attached to an action doesn't mean that people are going to always choose to do the right thing. And the right thing then gets us into the territory of ethics, which is something that we've also been looking to.
Okay. Well, if anyone from the Myanmar military government or the Chinese government are listening, there's two big markets for this amber. You might want to go and check them out, because it doesn't sound like they're particularly playing by the rules. Might be some tax money in it for you. Who knows? Okay, so we got these two big markets. Who is the amber being sold to? Is it private collectors? Is it museums? Is it researchers?
All of the above, again. Yeah.
I mean, I think the market itself is free for all. It's who has the money to buy amber or any other gemstone, right? And in China, for example, this is something that has a lot of value culturally. So I would assume that a lot of people would buy it. And I think over the years, people have probably seen that researchers, like scientists, paleontologists, or private collectors, as you've said, are very much interested in it. And a lot of the dealers have learned to maybe look for fossil inclusions, because these can bring a lot of money. So if you have like a spider, for example, I think that could be around $1,000. If you have a dinosaur tail, well, we're talking in terms of the hundred thousands, you know. Generally, like insects, smaller insects could be sold for like $5. So actually, amber is not that expensive. If you look at one specimen, it does depend what sort of inclusions are in there. Who are the collectors, for example? What are they interested in? Who are the researchers? What are they researching? So there's a lot of factors that determine who buys the amber, I think. But in general, I think a lot of people have noticed that the market from scientists is getting bigger, especially because in China, there has been an economic collapse in the last years, which means that a lot of, you know, non-scientists might not be buying as much amber. So people might have to divert, you know, their targets in terms of buyers.
Yeah, it seems like there's a potential industry to be propped up, you know, like in between the people who are mining the amber and then eventually the researchers and whoever. Say, for instance, you have a fossil in amber, and you buy it cheaply based on the fact that whoever's selling it doesn't know really what's in there, but you recognize the value of the fossil, of that dinosaur tail that otherwise just looks like a fluffy whatever in the amber. Like, you can take something that's worth, you know, like $1,000 and turn it into $100,000 potentially.
Yeah. Easily. This is where we get into the exploitation side of things, where this definitely requires a long chain of people in order to get to the person who recognizes it as something very scientifically valuable. And the person at the very bottom of the chain, the miner, who's working in this horrific conditions, not only of the actual mine and doing the mining work, but also in a conflict zone where their livelihoods are depending on what's going on around them and conflict that they can't control. And they barely get a living wage out of it. And yet there's somebody down along the chain making a lot of money and a lot of scientific clout at the end of it as well.
So I'm a paleontologist. I have just seen this wonderful piece of fossil history, this nature paper waiting to be written, and all it's going to cost me is $100,000. If we take that money, where does it go? If we follow it all the way back, who is taking a cut out of it? And yeah, as you say, how much eventually ends up with the person that mined it out, how much is going to one of the military factions, how much to the dealers, can you follow that money?
As far as we've seen, no.
100,000 for an HRP, is it really worth it?
Yeah. It doesn't seem possible to trace back like that. But this is the excuse that a lot of people will use to say that, oh, we don't have any direct evidence that Amber Research or Myanmar Amber Research is impacting the conflict zone or exacerbating the problems there. And I don't think that's fair to say, because the money is going somewhere, right?
I mean, that's the problem with illicit trafficking. You never know where the money or how much of the money is going to which parties. What I can tell you is that the most of the money would be going to the military factions, so basically the national military that controls the routes from the mines to, for example, Tien Chung, the Kachin Independence Army, the other ones that control the mines themselves. A little bit might go to the miners, depending on who the miners are. So, for example, right now, or not right now, maybe like last year before the coup, what we knew about the situation was that there were a lot of large companies that were responsible for mining amber, and a lot of artisanal workers were actually illegally mining in those areas after hours, which actually caused a lot of accidents, and that's because they were no longer allowed to work in the mines. So there's a lot going on, and when it comes to this sort of problem, it's really, really hard to know how much money exactly is going where, but we do know that most of money would be going to the National Military and the Kachin Independence Army.
As a loose analogy, is it kind of similar to the financial pathways that buying illegal drugs would take? For instance, you can't really follow it, but then you can't assume that the money is going all the way back to, say, like the opium growers. You know, a huge amount of it is going to some unethical group who are using it for unethical purposes.
I guess that's definitely a pretty good analogy. Yeah.
Okay. And with drugs, I don't think that you can separate the purchase of drugs from the ethics. You can't just simply look at it as I'm just buying whatever drug of choice without it having any ethical implications.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so you said about journals and how there isn't really any questioning of where these fossils that are being reported in the journals are coming from. Which kinds of institutions have made rulings about the ethics of working with Burmese amber?
I think the Society for Vertebrate Paleontology, hats off really, they've really taken the lead to address this problem, even back in 2020. And they have, for example, released a letter back in, I think, was it April 2020, Emma?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and then as of last year, Emma and I are both involved in the committee that works on these sort of problems, and we've released another letter. But in terms of the other societies, I think recently the Palace made a statement. Is that correct, Emma?
They didn't make quite the same statement as the Society for Vertebrate Paleontology, which is based in the US, by the way. They didn't quite make the same statement, but they do now on their website, on the page where they talk about the kinds of papers that they will accept in their journal, Paleontology. They have a statement saying that all material must be legally sourced and that kind of stuff.
Okay. Are either of them enforcing it? Is there any way of proving that the fossil that you have and that you're reporting your findings of is legally sourced? Do you have like export documents, certificates, or anything like that?
You should be able.
I think if you would look at the laws, I don't think anyone has any legal fossil. Or anyone can claim that it was fully completely legal. But I think if you base it off the Jamestown law, which is what we currently are doing at the moment, you should have your paperwork, which, you know, states that it was exported illegally, it was imported legally. A lot of people don't seem to have that because, you know, if you bought it with just, you know, cash in hand, let's say, then you're unlikely to have this sort of document.
Yeah, we actually looked into this for the study that we did, and we took a selection of papers that had been published since SVP, the Society for Vertebrate Paleontology, since they released their letter in April 2020. And out of these publications, there was, I believe there was 174, and out of this, only three had any reference to the situation in Myanmar. And even before that, when we first started doing this research, we looked at all of the papers on Myanmar amber that had been recorded in the paleobiology database, which was a much smaller subset of the total number of papers on Myanmar amber, but it was still very informative. And looking at those papers, there was about maybe 200 or so of them, and this was dating back to 1990. And back then, only one of them made any reference to the sourcing of amber ethically and legally, but also one of them, so the exact same number, spoke about happy birthday to a celebrity. And now I can't remember what celebrity that was.
Was it Mick Jagger?
Yes, it was. Yeah, so yeah. There was the same number of papers talking about Mick Jagger's birthday and naming a specimen after him as there was describing how the Myanmar was amber was sourced legally and ethically.
Well, get your priorities right.
Right?
Wow.
But those three that have mentioned it, since the letter came out, hopefully they will become more plentiful as we go forward. And one of them was able to provide paperwork and put in the supplementary materials.
Emma, have you checked the latest paper that came out?
Because there's a paper that came out.
Does that increase the number to four?
It would, yes, indeed, actually, yeah. So the total number is now, as of this week, 175 and four. So the paper that came out most recently, according to our research, is the first Myanmar amber publication to include an author based in Myanmar, which is... It shouldn't be a milestone, absolutely should not, and should not be something to be celebrated. But we have not seen that yet since Myanmar amber research began in the 2000s, am I correct?
1995,
yes.
Well, sing the praises of this paper. Who are they? Do you know off the top of your head?
I believe this is two people that we work with on the Myanmar working group involved in this, and they are Juan Daza, who also had a great paper in Science recently that was one of the first ones to make direct reference to the SVP letter on ethical sourcing of Myanmar amber, and also Susan Evans, who's based at UCL. And I can definitely link you the paper so you can put it in the show notes, because it is quite a good example of how research can be ethical and legal. And obviously there's much, much more we can do, but steps in the right direction.
And I think one of them also is Adolf Peretti, who has a museum in Switzerland. And as far as I know, he has been quite involved in terms of putting the word out, but also actually doing something in Myanmar. So I'm not really sure on the logistics or the details, but I know that he supports miners in the internal displacement camps and things like that. So I'm assuming that the specimen would have come from his collection.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, it goes to show that it can be done ethically, so that is good. And obviously baby steps, with just that being the first in a very long time and such a low proportion. So the study that you two have done, been looking at all the different papers about amber from Myanmar. How many species from this amber, or papers on this amber, have been published recently?
When you say recently,
okay,
recently
from the 90s. Okay, let's go all the way back to when you started looking.
So,
and how has it changed over time then?
Okay, that's the important thing. I think the total number isn't something that we need to concentrate on. It's the trajectory of this trend. The very first publications on Myanmar amber started to appear in the late 90s. And then throughout the 2000s and into the 2010s, there was some papers. But around 2014, it just shoots up. And we get like hundreds of papers every year from 2016 onwards. And in 2016, we also see the publication of the dinosaur tail in amber and a few other very media friendly, let's say, specimens. And from
the media frenzy.
Yes, true. So that's when it all starts to get very more obvious that these kinds of specimens are getting into high publication or high impact journals with a lot of notoriety for the authors who publish on them.
Okay, and what is causing that increase? Is there something that happened that made amber more available? Was there, you know, some researchers coming into the field that really work on the minute details of fly genitalia and are able to make paper after paper after paper?
I don't know if we're allowed to talk about this, given that our paper is in the review. Mm-hmm. but I can tell you the general gist of it. So, and because this is something we've already talked about before. As from 2010, the Chinese amber mines tapped out, which meant that China had to look elsewhere to fill in this gap in the demand for amber. And they looked to their neighbor, Myanmar. So basically, as from this point onwards, there was a lot more of amber going towards China than before, which meant that a lot of researchers had more access to amber as from then on from the markets in Tianjin. And I think this is one of the main reasons why we saw this increase in publications. And that's just because a lot of researchers had more access to the material, because more material was being mined. So more material was going over the border to China. So more material was bought.
Mm-hmm. And to add a scientific layer on top of that, so we're talking about a lot of different things kind of coming together here. Myanmar amber wasn't confirmed to be Cretaceous in age until after the first publication started coming out on it. It was originally, I believe, thought to be Eocene. And that this started then to create more of a frenzy, because suddenly it was the age of the dinosaurs. And this then really gathered a lot of attention, scientifically speaking, but then the availability of it really added an extra layer on top.
Mm. And as you said, it's easy to get a nature paper out of an amber fossil. So that's also one of the reasons why a lot of people would go after it.
Yeah.
So who is publishing on these fossils? Who are the people that are making these papers?
The Myanmar amber papers.
Yeah.
Yes. everybody except people from Myanmar, basically.
Does that matter?
Yes. I think it does very much matter. So we're talking about, essentially what we're talking about here is pure, unabashed, parachute science, scientific colonialism, where there are people from, majority of people who work on Myanmar Amber are from the US or Northern America, Europe, particularly Western Europe, and also China. And they're very large, wealthy countries with many resources to work on this amber stuff and also purchase it. And they are taking the fossil heritage of another country and using it to further their own scientific careers and gains for themselves. And having a local author on a paper, even if it's not just a Myanmar Amber paper, provides such important context that authors who don't include local authors are really missing out on. And this might be anything to do with the scientific side of things, geological context, that kind of stuff, but also very simple things like every day moving around, getting to know the local areas, the local language, customs, cultures, that kind of stuff. And it's just not something that we should be tolerating in paleontology anymore. It's outdated way of doing things.
It's important to note right now that foreigners are not allowed in the mines. Mm. So actually, in terms of stratigraphy, in terms of geological context, we know very little when it comes to Myanmar Amber. And when you think of, you know, like the kind of work that paleontologists or paleobiologists do, this information is really, really important. But the very fact that it's missing and still we consider them to be so scientifically important without this information is very questionable, in my opinion.
Yeah, there are very few papers detailing the stratigraphy of the area and the age of this amber. I believe the most recent one was a 2012 paper.
So following on from our episode about decolonizing paleontology, there were a lot of vocal people, particularly on YouTube, and you can imagine the kinds of comments that we would be getting. So I will play devil's advocate with some of those opinions. So with a fossil, that the information in that fossil doesn't depend on anything to do with local modern local geography or nationality or anything like that. That fossil was there 65 million years ago plus. It's got nothing to do with the modern time. The information that's in there, if the best person to describe that is in the US or is in China, shouldn't they be the ones to get that information out of the fossil? Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.